Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Friday Weekly Media Roundtable. Thanks so much for joining us this week. It was a busy one. We had the rare opportunity to hear directly from FBI CEO Mark Zuckerberg about how his platform was used in the 2016 election and how it may continue to be used in some quarters to access personal data, in some cases without giving users notice or the ability to opt out. And a great many tech reporters were left feeling pretty unsatisfied with his responses. We'll review that coverage. Also, dozens of layoffs were just announced in the last few hours at the LA Times newspaper, and Denver Post newspaper reporters went on the record this week. They were begging their owner to stop laying off journalists. So what is the future of newspapers? Also, the Sinclair Network, owned by Conservative Brothers, already owns 190 local TV stations, and they're looking to buy about 30 more, but they're still facing fallout from those mandatory editorials that they required all their anchors across the country to read last week. The concern is about the ramifications of that. Also, California looking to pass urgent legislation to restore net neutrality. And there's the breaking news. The Comey book is out. The president is tweeting. And did Donald Trump's attorney tape client discussions? The FBI reportedly seized tapes in simultaneous raids. Does the presence of tapes somehow draw yet another parallel to Watergate? So much to get into today, and we have three venerable media pros with us to do just that. Starting in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Victor Picard is an associate professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is the co-editor of the book, entitled, ominously, Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And he's also author of America's Battle for Media Democracy. Thanks for joining us, Victor, on a very busy Friday in the news.
Yes, sounds like a lot is going on.
Also joining us, and from New York, is Scott Horton. Scott is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott Horton, thanks for joining us.
Be with you.
And finally, from Washington, D.C., Craig Aaron. Craig is president and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund, both of which are devoted to changing media and technology policy, as well as promoting the public interest and strengthening democracy. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. Well, we always like to start off with some good news. So in our kudos section, we want to start by highlighting good journalism. Victor Picard, let's start with you, shall we?
Sure. There are many candidates. There was some fantastic reporting this week on the Mark Zuckerberg testimony. But the journalist I would like to point out would be Mike Elk, who's been doing fabulous labor reporting, especially on the striking Oklahoma teachers. He's been talking about the role of women and people of color in that labor movement, and I think he just deserves some recognition for such great journalism.
Okay, and let's go with Scott Horton next. Who do you have kudos for this week?
I think it's an extraordinarily rich week, an awful lot of really powerful writing out there. A number of good exposés, but I'm going to give it to Dexter Filkins for an article in the current New Yorker called A Saudi Prince's Quest to Remake the Middle East. And I do that because I think this has been one of the most difficult areas for American journalists over the last couple of years, that specifically coverage of Saudi Arabia. It's a very closed society, but more importantly, the Saudis also have a massive PR operation running that seems to have captured an awful lot of the press reportage about Saudi politics and Saudi developments. And so I think Filkin's piece is very, very powerful, deep insights, and a critical perspective, which is particularly rare in our coverage of Saudi Arabia. And I think he also points to a number of issues that are likely to emerge in the future coming out of the region, relations with Iran, with Syria, but also the interface with the American political sector, the dealings with Jared Kushner and the president in particular.
And in many ways, I think that that visit kind of flew under the radar a bit, didn't it?
That's right. I mean, it got Hollywood reporter coverage, but not a lot of really serious political reportage, I don't think.
All right. And Craig Aaron, who do you have kudos for?
Well, I'd like to highlight a piece that ran last weekend on BuzzFeed called "We Had to Stop Facebook When Anti-Muslim Violence Goes Viral," by Megha Rajagopalan and Aisha Nazim, which was a piece about Sri Lanka and the challenges faced there around what happens when something like Facebook is really weaponized to push violence against religious minorities in the country, and really big questions underneath about what are the roles of tech companies, what are the roles of governments, who should be making these decisions. So I thought that was a well-reported and a pretty thought-provoking piece.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let's do this in sort of a chronological manner, starting with things that happened earlier in the week. Victor Picard, you mentioned the Facebook coverage, so let's start with that and Mark Zuckerberg's appearance before Congress. I'm wondering if some of the criticism of Zuckerberg didn't actually belong with those who were questioning him. I got the feeling that senators and Congress people were kind of out of their depth when it came to even trying to pull information out of him, because they just didn't quite understand the technology here. Did you get that feeling as well?
I think that's a fair assessment. I think, and I should preface this by saying that I have not... I must confess that I haven't watched all the hours of testimony, but I've certainly read a lot about it and I've seen a lot of clips. And I think it's fair to say that politicians clearly demonstrated a lack of understanding about the technology at times. But I feel like some of that criticism has been a little bit overwrought, that really what we saw there, I would put more critical scrutiny on Zuckerberg and some of the evasive answers that he would give. And I also think that this drew attention. If anything, I guess I'm cautiously optimistic about where the debate is headed right now, because it's drawing a lot of attention to Facebook's unaccountable monopoly power and the pernicious effects that has, not just on our privacy, but also on our democracy and the ability by which we can communicate and actually have access to free-flowing information. So I really think it drew attention to some really important social problems. And so I was happy, I guess you could say, with some of the discourse, at least the surrounding discourse, the news coverage of these congressional hearings.
And Craig Aaron, you're the CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. You know, I was watching and thinking, wow, seeing Mark Zuckerberg in a suit and tie, sitting on a booster seat and answering questions, it was almost like a unicorn sighting. And he was so prepared. Every response was preceded by senator, senator, senator. And I'm sure they prepared him well, but I'm sure they would have probably told him, you don't have to say senator or congressperson before every response. But generally, in general, how do you think he did in sort of deflecting criticism of his platform?
Well, I'll have my team get back to you on that. No, I think that definitely, you know, I did somewhat unfortunately sit through about 8 hours of the testimony, and I think he was more successful at day one in sort of deflecting and maybe throwing folks off the scent a little bit, and being able to sort of tie the discussion into, technically that's not how it works, and let me explain again to you about advertising. And, not every member of Congress was equipped with sharp follow-up questions. But I think I tend to agree with Victor that, over the course of the 2 days of testimony, there were so many important issues raised, and these are really big questions. So, well, I think Zuckerberg, sort of from the theater critic perspective, did pretty well, and that the members had a hard time landing too many sharp blows, if you will. The fact that we're actually having a political discussion about Facebook's power, we're actually debating, should we have regulation? Are there antitrust solutions? What should our privacy protections be? What does this mean for the future of the media? Though I would have liked a few more questions about that. I think that's huge, and as a start to a way overdue discussion. Obviously, it would have been great if we'd had some of these debates before Facebook was the giant force that it is, but the fact that we're having it now, that Congress is at least taking it seriously on a rhetorical level, I think opens up the political space for policy change, for policy debate, and there's a lot more of that space than there was a couple of weeks ago.
And Scott Horton, author of Lords of Secrecy, this is right in your wheelhouse. What stood out for you, both in what you heard and how the media has been covering Facebook in light of the recent scandals?
Well, I think the really big point that came out of all this was we need fresh blood in Congress. We had, particularly on the Senate side, but actually both days, we had weak questioning. A lot of questions whose premises disclosed a faulty understanding of how Facebook operates and its business model, a failure to follow through with aggressive questions. That's a shame because, of course, these hearings really should have brought a sharp focus on Facebook and the issues that surround Facebook and the need for changes with Facebook and other social media companies, but also the need for regulatory change. That barely got vetted in the course of the hearings, and that's an area where I think we're falling far behind. There should have been a lot more focus on what measures are going to be taken by way of legislation and regulation to remedy these failings.
The representative from Alaska, Dan Sullivan, pointed out, he said that when companies become big and powerful, what typically happens from his body is that there's an instinct to either regulate or break it up. But then he said that regulation isn't the best solution, and one of the committee members even asked Mark Zuckerberg to help them write the regulation. So where does that leave us in terms of being able to rely on lawmakers to be able to handle a behemoth like this, Scott?
Well, we have a Republican majority right now which is has a mantra opposed to regulation. And that's the reason why, even though you saw occasional grudging acceptance that something's got to happen, you saw a failure to actually moot or present specific regulatory ideas. And I think they're pretty obvious models for them to be looking at. And some of them come from Europe. I mean, the Europeans have imposed much more effective restraints to protect the privacy rights of citizens than we've ever had in place in the United States. I mean, that's just one model that ought to be thought about much more carefully here.
Frankly, I thought that model would have come up more often than it actually did. So that was just one of the things that surprised me. For those of the listeners out there just joining us, thanks for being here. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We do it every Friday, and today we have a full plate, and we're joined by Victor Picard, Associate Professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, Scott Horton, Contributing Editor at Harper's Magazine, and from Washington, D.C., Craig Aaron, President and CEO of the Free Press Action Fund. And if you had a news story that stood out for you this week, please give us a call. 866-798-8255 is the number. Gentlemen, we have so much to get to this week, but I was really struck, just got notice that the LA Times has just laid off a couple of dozen more reporters. I was also struck by that photo of the Denver Post reporters. in effect begging for their jobs, begging the newspaper's owners, please stop laying off journalists. Victor Picard, what were your thoughts when you saw that? I'm assuming that you saw that photo. It was really chilling to me.
Oh, it's very troubling, and I guess I would have to say that as depressing as it is, but my immediate reaction is that this is no surprise. I mean, this we've seen the writing on the wall for a long time that the current business model for supporting newspapers in particular is doomed, really, and we have to figure out alternative ways to fund journalists. I think we're going to see, unfortunately, continued hemorrhaging as we watch these newspapers become just gutted and shuttered across the country. We're hearing about things like news deserts. Increasingly, local journalism is disappearing. So I think this is a huge social problem, and as a nation, we really need to be talking about this much more.
Craig Aaron, I'm wondering if you can find a causal relationship. Are newspapers going out of business and cutting back because fewer people are reading, or are fewer people reading because of the quality of news that they're getting from the newspapers?
I think it's certainly a symbiotic relationship. And the thing that, you know, often gets left out, you know, it's really easy to look at the media landscape as it is today. And we are in a huge transformation. We just spent a lot of time talking about Facebook. And there have been changes, and there have been economic downturns and deep changes to the advertising market. But so many of the problems that afflict local newspapers in these countries were self-inflicted. We saw years and years of runaway media consolidation, concentration, the loss of local ownership, these kind of cutbacks that have left us in a situation where if, you know, one newspaper gets sick in one community, it takes a bunch of other communities with them. And this, we're looking at what's left of the Tribune network. You're beginning to see that, although part of the story of the Los Angeles Times layoffs today is that the paper is actually being sold back to another owner. So that, you know, there's a lot of people in that newsroom who weren't part of the digital division that got let go that are optimistic about the new ownership. But I think when you look at the case of the Denver Post and a bunch of the Bay Area papers that are also owned by this same hedge fund, we allowed this situation to happen where the only owners available were these absentee owners, and the hedge funds have moved in to really pick at the carcasses of these once great newspapers, and they've taken away so much of the value, sold off the properties, and just gone for cutback after cutback after cutback, where even a thriving city like Denver is talking about its major newspaper maybe having fewer than 50 people in the newsroom, which is just appalling. So there's a lot of people who share this responsibility. The industry shares this itself, and the government shares it because they looked the other way and really encourage this kind of concentration and consolidation that has made this once healthy industry and this industry that is so essential to a functioning democracy. They helped create a lot of the trouble that we're really just truly experiencing now.
I just wonder if there's even a way out of the crisis. I mean, just putting the words hedge fund and daily newspaper in the same sentence seems to me to be a death knell, but I don't know.
I think there are ways, but they take some really big thoughts, big ideas, some radical rethinking, like I think what Victor's suggesting here, which is we have to really ask ourselves as a country, you know, if we value local news gathering, if we realize that local journalism is essential for our ability to self-govern, to be informed about what those in power are doing, then we have to change the way we fund it. We have to look at different models. We have to look at public support. We have to look at what these institutions are doing to actually connect with and serve their communities. And that doesn't mean simply restructuring, you know, big giant newspaper newsrooms like we had 15 or 20 years ago. You know, they're going to be new models. They're going to be grounded in community, but we really need to begin to open the door to those conversations and to start those conversations at the local level with the communities that are supposed to be served. So the questions aren't just, you know, what's the most profitable or how can you capture eyeballs with sort of cookie cutter content or lowest common denominator content, but what do communities actually need? I think as the news industry begins to have those conversations, it gets a lot more hopeful because there are alternative ways to do this. There's examples from communities. There's examples from elsewhere in the world. We've just taken it in the other direction, and we're beginning to reap the results.
You know, we were just discussing in the newsroom this morning that there's a local publication that garnered 300 core contributors who came up with $1 million to keep this alternative source of news alive. And your idea that maybe the PBS approach to newspapers is what the future looks like, I just think that's just chilling. Did you have any thoughts on that, Scott?
I think we should look at the success stories we see out there right now. Particularly look at the New York Times and Washington Post, which are seeing surging subscriptions and revenues right now. And that's, I think, largely related to what's going on in Washington today and a sense of a continuous crisis and a demand by the public to be fed and to learn about what's going on and a demand for expose journalism. So I think the question is whether or not we can tap some of that same energy on the local level, and it seems to me it ought to be possible to do, but it it certainly requires an awakening of the civic consciousness, and it requires different models. But I think the subscriber basis is going to wind up being part of the answer.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Victor Picard, communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with Craig Aaron, and he's the CEO of the Free Press Action Fund and Free Press. And Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. What news stories stood out for you this week? Give us a call, 866-798-8255 is the number. I don't know about you gentlemen, but I'm still smarting from watching that montage of the Sinclair Broadcasting anchors across the country reading the exact same wording, warning Americans of fake news and biased news when it came from a parent company that is associated with President Trump, that has mandatory editorials that must be carried by conservative editorialists. I'm just still smarting from that. Victor, did you have the same response?
Yes, I found it deeply troubling.
Yeah.
Funny at the same time, but funny in a very disturbing way. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this kind of media concentration has been going on for a long time. It's been a problem for a long time. And what you typically see with that kind of media ownership concentration is a loss of local voices, a loss of jobs in the news sector overall. But what you find with Sinclair is the worst of two bad worlds, this economic scenario that I just mentioned, but also this far right-wing political agenda. And so the idea that these formulaic must-run commentaries can be piped down through your local stations. Many people won't really notice the difference right away, which is so insidious. It's not like their local news commentators are going to be wearing T-shirts that say Sinclair Broadcast Group on them. Mm-hmm. It's coming from these local affiliates. So that's really deeply troubling. It's very propagandistic when people can't tell where the source of their information is coming from. That's very unhealthy for the public sphere.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to pick up where we left off talking here about Sinclair and why they have such an interest in grabbing local TV stations. Is it because they are so profitable, or is it because being able to get your views out in local markets is ideologically preferable? We're going to take a quick break and we'll come right back. Stay with us.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org. Or why not tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, a further roundtable of the week's news with 1A with Joshua Johnson from WAMU in Washington. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Today, we're talking everything from Facebook to Cambridge Analytica and Donald Trump and Sinclair Network. So join us, 866-798-8255 is the number. What news story stood out for you this week? We're talking with Victor Picard. He's an associate professor of communication at the venerable Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And finally, Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press Action Fund, devoted to changing media and technology policy and promoting public interest and democracy. You know, in watching, going back to the Sinclair broadcasts, you know, having been a local anchor, I know the pressure that they must have been under. It's a great job. It's interesting. It's exciting. It's high profile. It's fun. It pays the bills. But it occurred to me that I don't recall hearing a single story of a single one of those anchors refusing or at least putting some kind of caveat ahead of that editorial, letting the viewers know that this was mandated by the owner. Craig, what did you get a chill when you didn't hear of any stories of anybody refusing to do this?
I think it is chilling, but I think it also shows you just how afraid those journalists and those anchors are of losing their jobs, that they felt like they had no choice but to go and parrot these lines and follow the directive from corporate headquarters, because that's how Sinclair operates, and they're ruthless. I mean, I've been tracking Sinclair since 2004, and they play hardball. They force all these anchors to sign contracts that have non-compete clauses with severe penalties. They're constantly pushing, certain content, certain storylines. They stepped further across the line this time because it wasn't just, hey, make sure you run this package or don't forget to run this Trump spokesperson's commentary 9 times a week, but actually putting words in the mouths of their own anchors, although that also not for the first time. A lot of their national coverage and scripts get handed down from corporate headquarters, and it's extremely dangerous because Sinclair is so committed to a one-sided, slanted take on the news. And as Victor suggested, it's mixed in, you know, so in between sports, weather, and, you know, often very good local journalists trying to do their jobs comes this kind of slanted national and international coverage, these just really insane packages like the terrorism alert desk, which is basically just an excuse for them to run a series of anti-Muslim stories, and on down the list of what Sinclair does. And now they own more television stations than any company in America and want to get even bigger and move into the biggest markets. And they are being very brazen and very clear that when they do that, they're not looking to change what they do. They're looking to change these local stations and force them to toe Sinclair's line.
They already own 193 stations. They're looking to buy 40 more, and that would extend their reach into three-quarters of the country. I'm starting to get this mental picture of a map with this color oozing across the country. It just seems so insidious. It feels like the worst possible kind of monopoly. Victor Picard, your thoughts?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. It's troubling on a number of levels. But if I could, this might be an opportunity to think of alternatives. And one thing that one proposal that I think unites all these problems, the Sinclair media concentration problem, the Facebook monopoly problem, the journalism crisis, I think increasingly we're going to have to look to non-market-based means of support for actual journalism. I think public alternatives to this increasingly concentrated and commercialized media system is really our only way out of this mess. And so I want to underscore that it doesn't have to be this way, that we really need to start thinking about structural alternatives, because many of these trends that we're talking about in today's discussion are only going to get worse. We're only going to lose more journalists. We're going to see further concentration, especially with this current Federal Communications Commission. So I think we have to think really outside of the box, think about entirely new alternative models.
Well, I don't know. Every time I get one of those things where you can check the box if you want to donate to, I don't know, a local something or other, whether it's the tax form that gives you that option or the DMV registration, every time I have the option, I don't know too many people who do. So depending on people to understand the value of the Fourth Estate and be willing to underwrite the cost of that, I don't know. Scott Horton, do you have any predictions about whether that's a model that has legs?
I think it'd be very difficult. I think, you know, we need to look at the origins of what's going on right now with Sinclair back in the course of the 2016 presidential campaign, because we know that during that campaign, Steve Bannon, a number of Trump's donors, and Trump himself were in active discussions with Sinclair about the creation of a new network. In fact, it even got the name Trump TV, and there were broad expectations that Trump was going to lose that election and was going to go into the media in a big way with this operation. So this really is it is a blatantly partisan political operation. And that presents some challenges for us, and it's challenges that we used to be able to address with the Fairness Doctrine, and having that doctrine fade away has created our current problem. So I think the solution is to find a way to steer back towards something like the Fairness Doctrine.
One of our listeners just sent us an email. Clifford Stanley says, if journalism moves toward a predominantly subscription model, doesn't that mean that those with less income and less to spend on being informed will be less informed? Information only for the affluent, and only that subset of the affluent that really cares about being well informed. What a scary thought, he says. And in a related observation and question, many of the people I meet in tech and living in the Bay Area, I meet a lot, don't care about or follow the news in detail. They're techno-optimists who still think that all the problems can be engineered away. If, as I think is the case, that population can't be counted on to support subscription-based journalism, who will have the money to support it? Any thoughts on that?
I'll take a few of those.
Who's that?
This is Craig. I want to jump on a bunch of things that folks said. I mean, I think that concern about, you know, news only for the elite or only the wealthy being able to get it is a huge problem, and it is one of the reasons we have to look at some of the solutions Victor is talking about. Because if we end up in news media where only specialized audiences are served, only the insiders are served, news increasingly gets disconnected from community, we're going to have some big problems, and we still have to answer this question of where is the money going to come from? And I do think that requires looking at structural solutions. I actually would oppose a reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. I think that we get in trouble when we start giving the government the power to regulate speech or content. I can only imagine what the Trump administration would do with Fairness Doctrine challenges and how they would treat it. But if we actually look at some of the structural solutions, how do we ensure that there are a diversity of local voices? You didn't used to be able to own more than 7 television stations in the entire country. We've obviously gone the other way, and I think we have to expand our imagination of what's possible. Where could the money come from? If Facebook is the problem, if advertising is the problem, why don't we start taxing advertising? Victor's written about this before. What if we took a tiny bit of the cost of advertising and started devoting it to investing in community journalism and local communities? What if we just changed the tax structure around advertising to accomplish the same ends? We've got a bill we're pushing in the state of New Jersey. They sold some of their public television stations in an auction, and they raised $300 million doing that. Why isn't that being reinvested locally and in community journalism? The fact is, ultimately, the money is out there. But we do have to change this conversation. And I understand how bleak it looks in a moment where Sinclair is expanding, but even their deal's not done yet. So it becomes our challenge is to, I think, push back at some of what you flagged of like, oh, why should I care? Why am I going to check the box? Is that the challenge that those of us who care about the future of media and care about journalism is that we actually have to build a constituency willing to fight for it. And for a long time, journalists have been so afraid of the idea of taking political action, of even asking for that kind of support, at a fear of being perceived as, you know, being subjective or what have you, that they've allowed their bosses to run around and create a lot of the disaster we're staring at. And as we get close to rock bottom, and I think Denver's really close, and a lot of other places, it is one of those moments, I think, to rethink how we've done it before and open ourselves to some new ideas and solutions that haven't been on the table because it hasn't been this bad.
And Victor, you have weighed in on some of the new approaches. What are some of those new approaches? And also, the FCC is supposed to be the firewall between those who would wish to profit and those who are vested in getting true information. So the FCC doesn't appear to be that bulwark anymore. But what are some of the inventive approaches that you've thought of?
Yes, well, I'm not sure how inventive they are. And first, I want to agree with you about the FCC. I mean, right now we have a classic textbook scenario of a captured regulatory agency. Essentially, they are performing the desires. They're serving the desires of the very industries they're meant to oversee. So I don't think we can look to the FCC for any protections or solutions at this time. But I do think we can look abroad to what other democracies are doing and even to our own history, where we recognize that the market simply could not support the level of journalism that a democracy requires. I feel that I think the evidence points to this always being true. And what we're seeing today is that these long-term tensions are really beginning to explode with the actual implosion of commercial journalism. So the classic best-case scenario is to look at strengthening our already existing public media systems. We've kept our PBS and NPR impoverished all these years. That's probably not going to happen anytime soon during the Trump era, but it's something that we need to keep on the table. More immediately, I think we're seeing an opportunity where people might be able to connect the dots and think about taxing Facebook and Google, which is essentially a duopoly right now. They're taking about 75% of current digital advertising revenue. That's starving news organizations. And of course, it's a tragic irony that they're also profiting from the content that these beleaguered news organizations are producing. So I think this is something that we might be able to at least get people talking about now that Facebook is under such scrutiny.
And a lot of it might fall, like you said, to individuals and even states. I know the FCC repeal of net neutrality means that several states have had to step up, and they're being pretty aggressive, including California, in standing up for what the FCC struck down. So once again, we might have to look in other places other than the federal government for these protections. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Victor Picard, Scott Horton, and Craig Aaron on the Friday Media Roundtable. What news stories struck your fancy this week? 866-798-8255, or you can send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Let's move on to another development this week. President Trump, very, very angry. if his tweets are any indication, he is furious that the FBI has raided his lawyer, Michael Cohen's office, his hotel room, and his home. Scott, you've been following this. Can you give us a quick rundown of what happened? How did the FBI get the warrant to remove those documents, including personal communications, potentially with President Trump?
Well, I think we should start with the fact that, just with the observation that this is a very rare thing. So these sorts of raids on law offices have happened historically in the past, but they haven't happened frequently. And they've usually happened in cases where the lawyer was actually involved in some sort of crime, where the evidence of the criminal activity was high. Most frequently, that's been in cases involving the mob. And the Department of Justice lays out a series of very elaborate steps that have to be followed before such a raid can be taken. Those steps require review of a whole series of different offices within the organization, and usually a sign-off from the Attorney General himself, or in this case, it was the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who signed off on them. And then they had to be brought before a judge who had to review and approve it. And usually these sorts of applications get very close scrutiny from the judge who reviews them. So so we don't know exactly what was represented to obtain the warrant in this case. That would be confidential information, usually in the form of FBI affidavits, but it would have had to have been pretty powerful stuff to have gotten the order that they secured. So now the raids having been carried out, the materials being collected, these would inevitably include a lot of attorney-client privilege materials, and that creates a big problem for the Department of Justice and how to manage them. So usually they create a what's called a privilege team that will be screening everything before it actually goes to the prosecutors. And in this case, we see another pretty unusual act, which is a preemptive motion just filed today by Michael Cohen, in which he's seeking to suppress the use of the materials before any use is even being attempted by the government. Usually these sorts of suppression motions only occur after an indictment is filed and there's an effort to actually use evidence. So Cohen is moving preemptively. That's a pretty aggressive footing for him to take as well.
But wouldn't any attorney worth his salt have seen this potentially coming and removed anything incriminating? I just don't know. Maybe I'm looking too deeply into it, or maybe I've read too many Robert Ludlum novels. I don't know. But it just seems to me that it might be kind of Machiavellian that they deliberately salted the files with things that are exculpatory. I don't know. Craig Aaron, what do you think?
Wow, I'm still sort of having my daily reminder that this is not normal.
Yeah.
And I think what really strikes me and what Scott said is these are tactics usually reserved for dealing with the mob. And, you know, that appears to be what we're dealing with here. Those kind of approaches, those kind of tactics, you know, that seems to be the way that the Trump legal team has usually operated, strong-arming folks and threats and countersuits and all of these things. But it's hard for me to believe that the Justice Department, the special counsel, et cetera, would take, the office in New York would take any of these steps without, the strongest evidence and the clearest signs that there is really something there worth finding. And I know they went, into his hotel room as well, I think probably looking for some of those materials that they were worried they wouldn't find in the office. So it feels to me like we're a lot closer to the beginning than the end of this one, but we just haven't seen anything like it before. And when you look at a week that's coming, obviously all the attention sort of shifting to Comey and all the things Trump has been saying about the former FBI director today, this would be the most, captivating sort of Washington thriller if I didn't have to keep reminding myself that it's reality.
It just almost takes your breath away. What's the metaphor? It's like drinking from a fire hose. It's just so much that it's overwhelming, but it's also kind of numbifying. You just can't keep up with it, and at some point, I think there's a hope out there that people will just tune out and just not continue to pay attention. Victor Picard, professor at the Annenberg School for Communication. Is it possible that an attorney would keep tapes? Did we learn nothing from Watergate? And is that possible that the tapes draw yet another parallel to Watergate, Victor?
Yes, I think those parallels are unavoidable and certainly have given us, or at least given members of the media, a kind of ready-made narrative. But really, this reminds me of just a bad reality television show. And it's something that it's kind of taken over our media world, so that, you know, with each tweet, we have more breathless coverage of what's going on. And it just worries me. I just wonder about all the other problems that aren't being covered, because so much of our news media attention is focused on every move in the White House and all the drama that's associated with it. So there's a part of me that's always wondering, you know, as much as I want to remind ourselves that this isn't normal, and I do wonder whether maybe it's even better sometimes if people are just tuning out, I also kind of want to remind ourselves that we need to be focusing on other problems out there, not just the Trump show.
What do you think should be shoved up to the top of people's consciousness instead of, oh, say, golden showers?
In my view, there are so many major social and even global problems, growing inequality in this country, also just the direct impacts of some of the policy changes that not only being pushed by Trump himself, but all the regulatory agencies. As much as we've been talking about Sinclair in this discussion, I don't think there's been enough discussion of the actual policy changes that made that possible. So that would be, and of course, global climate change is something that we really should be talking about as well.
Craig Aaron, you represent the Free Press Action Fund, and part of your mandate is to strengthen democracy. And I think that we are at a time in history when reporters doing their jobs and doing it well and doing it courageously, and sometimes in death-defying ways. I'm not convinced that there aren't dangers in covering this kind of skullduggery, but in terms of strengthening democracy as one of your mandates, talk about the role that reporters are going to play, have been playing, and will play going forward as things begin to unfold.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is essential. We cannot have a functioning government without an informed citizenry. We need reporters out there digging in the places, following the stories, following the money to the places that none of us as individuals going work every day, unless we're journalists, have the opportunity to do. And there are fewer journalists out there doing it than there used to be, but their role only becomes more important. And I do take some solace in the fact that the crimes and misdemeanors of this administration, the challenges of this moment, have inspired a lot of journalists to do some of their best work, to dig harder, to stay on the story, to continue to ask tough questions. Now, we're in the danger of these sort of alternate realities of a lot of journalists working hard and then this counterweight that is Sinclair, you know, pushing the propaganda down straight out of the talking points. But in the end, I think the journalists win. I think the resistance, the backlash to what has happened in this country over the last couple of years, I take a lot of solace in just how much energy I'm seeing from the grassroots and just how many people I see, you know, rethinking the roles of the journalists, rethinking their roles, you know, not as stenographers, not as people to just write down what politicians say, but actually go in and challenge and follow up and check the facts. So we need it more than ever, and I do think we have a chance, really, to get it. It's far, far from hopeless.
I've been so proud to see some of the reporting, Scott Horton, but there is some journalistic legerdemain going on, as Craig pointed out, where people are really very confused, and rightfully so, if they don't know how to vet the information that they're getting. How do they know what's true and what's not? And isn't that the dark, ugly place where really dangerous regimes can come from, where people are confused about what's true and what's not? Scott?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think when we've seen authoritarian regimes rise in what was previously a democratic space, that's always been paralleled with tabloid journalism of a sort that disregards the truth, focuses on the trashy and seedy, and gets people to reject the idea of good government generally. And I think that fits in exactly with what we're dealing with now with Michael Cohen. And one thing I would say, guarantee you, we see a lot of focus on children born out of wedlock, affairs with porn stars and so forth. I can guarantee you the FBI and the federal prosecutors don't care about that. What they're focused on right now is money. Mm. Where did this money come from? Who provided this money? How is this money being used? And for this to be handled from the Southern District of New York, I think that means pretty strongly we're talking about foreign money and we're talking about mob money. That's the only thing that would justify what happened on Monday.
Well, I've got about 3 minutes left, gentlemen, and I was watching Good Morning America today and watched the interview with Comey about his book. With our last minute, let's start with you, Craig. Tell me, who's going to win the war of words? Is it Comey or Trump?
Well, I think the war of words, boy, Trump has proven hard to beat when it comes to those individual words. But I think the last word is going to come from somebody else. I don't know if it's going to be Comey. I think it might be the voters, but I think there's a lot more to come out. I don't think we're going to get it in this book, but I think we might get it in everything Scott is talking about as just the corruption and depravity of this administration and a lot of the people around it continues to be exposed.
And Victor Picard, who wins the war of words, Comey or Trump?
I agree with Craig. I think that ultimately it will be the American voters. We've got midterm elections coming up not too far off, and I think there's some comeuppance that hopefully we'll see in our politics as there's greater grassroots engagement. So that's how I would answer the question.
And finally, who haven't we heard from?
Well, I'd say Trump will win the war of words in the National Enquirer, and at that level, I mean, he's a professional when it comes to that. He's going to lose the war of words in the courts because I think what he says just doesn't have any real weight to it, and that's where Comey will definitely beat him. But the big question in the end is in the political forum and with the voters, and on that question, it's a test of the maturity of our democracy.
I am so grateful to have three venerable media professionals having joined us today in such a busy week in the news. Thank you to all three of you, Victor Picard of the Annenberg School for Communication, to Scott Horton of Harper's Magazine, and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare, and Craig Aaron, President and CEO of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for those who wrote in to us, too, in this busy week. That's it for your call and the Friday Media Roundtable. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Joshua Wildner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is chief engineer, and studio engineer is David LaTulipe. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this has been Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable.